We have the next panel, and the moderator, the chair of that panel, will be my colleague here at Glendon, Professor Francis Garon, whose specialty is in public policy, and also head of the graduate program in public and international affairs. Let me let him introduce the speakers now.
Alors, bonjour à tous. Nous sommes maintenant rendus au panel sur le fédéralisme. Donc, le fédéralisme, cet arrangement institutionnel dont le Canada s'est doté en 1867. Comme il a été mentionné hier, le fédéralisme est fondé sur l'idée d'accommoder la diversité en accordant l'autonomie nécessaire aux entités fédérées, ce qu'on a appelé hier le « self-rule », et à la fois d'assurer une forme d'unité entre les diverses composantes, ou ce qu'on a appelé « shared rule ». Au-delà de ce principe fondamental, et comme tout arrangement institutionnel, le fédéralisme évolue en fonction du contexte et des événements. Le fédéralisme canadien a donc pris différentes formes au cours de son histoire, et différentes appellations ont été utilisées pour tenter de le décrire. Par exemple, la première période, dont Peter Russell a fait mention, a parfois été associée au quasi-fédéralisme. En raison de l'esprit centralisateur qui régnait chez certains acteurs de l'époque. Il y a eu des périodes qui ont été qualifiées de fédéralisme d'urgence, comme par exemple lors des grands conflits mondiaux ou de la grande crise économique de 1929. Ces événements ont grandement influencé l'évolution du fédéralisme. Plus récemment, on a également parlé de fédéralisme coopératif, lors des efforts, par exemple, consentis à mieux coordonner les politiques sociales entre les différents niveaux de gouvernement. Donc, aujourd'hui, est-ce que notre pratique du fédéralisme nous permet d'aborder de façon efficace et légitime les grands enjeux auxquels font face les Canadiennes et les Canadiens? Nos relations avec les populations autochtones, les changements climatiques, les soins de fin de vie, dont nous parlera Cali aujourd'hui, sont de ces grands enjeux et on peut réfléchir à la question de savoir si l'évolution de notre pratique du fédéralisme est adéquat pour nous aider à aborder ces grands enjeux. Alors, sans plus tarder, je vous présente les trois panélistes. Donc, un panel entièrement composé de femmes. Très intéressant. Donc, so the first we'll talk. Katie Brock is a professor at the School of Public Policy and at the Department of Political Studies at Queen's University. She's a past president of the Canadian Associations of Program in Public Administration and National Research Chair for the Institute of Programs in Public Administration. She has published books, articles, and reports on the nonprofit sector, Canadian governance and comparative politics and government, federalism and constitutional matters, and Aboriginal governance issues. She's currently writing a book on the operation of the Canadian federal system and a new study called Riding the Trump Trudeau Wave. So I can't wait to read this. And finally, she's been active in public affairs as a nonpartisan advisor to the federal, provincial, and territorial governments, political parties, and Aboriginal organizations. Katie?
Thank you, Francis. And thank you so much for inviting me to be here. It's really a pleasure. And I've learned so much listening to the other speakers. It's been a truly excellent conference. So thank you. So I'm just going to set up my timer here. And when I got the topic, I was asked to come and speak on federalism. And I thought, OK, so I'm going to pick up and talk about Section 94, which is one of my passions right now. And then I read the description, and so I thought, no, perhaps I better alter this. So instead, I've decided to do something in conformity with the little description for this panel, which is about society and public policy as well. So, and I have a PowerPoint presentation for good or bad, and some slides will go through very quickly, but I'll just begin. So, when I look at Canadian federalism, one of the questions that I keep coming across is it working? does it work well? And certainly that comes out of the constitutional days. And even when Justice LaBelle was speaking, he did talk about effective federalism. And this is one of the concerns that I've had. But also, one of the things I've been working on, and I'm working on in my manuscript, is trying to bring together both the views that have come out of the Francophone academic community and the Anglophone academic community, and try to reconcile them. So I'm trying to develop a more normative test for how well our institutions are operating, which comes more out of the Francophone scholarship than it does out of the Anglophone. But I think if we tie the normative test to effectiveness, we can bridge the two worlds nicely. So that's my assumption in doing this. So, contrary to much argument, I argue that our federal institutions are working very well. And I differ from some of the speakers up to date because I believe the Founding Fathers did provide us with a framework for addressing many of the current problems that we see in our society or the current challenges. They didn't have all the answers, they didn't have all the institutions in place, but they gave us a nice flexibility in the Constitution with some guiding principles going forward. Now, part of this is based on the fact that I see John A. Macdonald as only one, albeit powerful, spokesperson for the Constitution. But I also looked at the ideas of the other founding fathers, like McGee and Mowat, and I found them very, very influential. So when we fast forward to today, the Federation must be responsive to societal changes, economic changes, how well our institutions are adapting is a primary concern here. And ultimately, are they serving citizens effectively? The case study I chose to work on, and I've worked on this in a few different contexts now, is the medical assistance in dying, to see, well, how well have our federal institutions responded to what is perceived as an important social need, and one that was put onto the political agenda by the Supreme Court of Canada, quite squarely. This is a really good test case because it does involve federal criminal jurisdiction, but then it engages provincial jurisdiction in health, around which the Supreme Court said you cannot draw a bright line, that you have to have collaboration, and it's part of the series of decisions that the court has made saying the provinces and federal government must collaborate and must collaborate even more effectively. So, the promise of federalism then is to disperse power in such a way that it benefits citizens. That's my basic assumption. That you want a balance between unity and diversity, and although in the paper I go into that in more depth, I'm not going to go into it here, but essentially you want a sense of the political whole, a binding unity. And our founders of the nation conceived this as a civic loyalty, a loyalty to the crown that would be above governments, above partisanship, but a loyalty that would ultimately benefit the citizens. It would create a binding community. It also embraces diversity, and for that, multiple communities, interests at national and subnational levels, and within the subnational units. A deep federalism, a deep diversity. And there has to be a flexibility, as we've heard in the presentations up till now, respecting the autonomy of both levels of government, serving the interests of citizens and the various communities throughout Canada. And one of the key things that we have to keep in mind is that citizens are entitled to benefits. And we embrace factions, we don't eschew them. We accept that there will be competing interests, there will be different interests, and our task has to be to balance them. So we want a federalism that enhances democratic values, that enhances diversity, and policies act in harmony, or at least not against each other. In reality, I think a lot of our policies fall somewhere in between. But ultimately, in the words of Ron Watts, it's in the interplay of social foundations, the written constitutions, and the actual practices and activities of governments that an understanding of the nature and effectiveness of the federal system is to be found. So I have a test that I've developed in my manuscript for a number of areas of our federation that I address in the book, but it's basically how well do the federal political institutions reflect the social and political balance of forces within our system? Do they channel differences into peaceful means? And do we get the appropriate balance between unity and diversity? And ultimately, are the best interests of citizens being served? So let's go to our test case then. And I'm not going to go into much depth on the test case, other than to say it is an issue that has come up originally as assisted suicide, but now we talk about medical assistance in dying. In 1993, we had a Supreme Court decision that seemed to settle the issue, but in the words of David Thomas, it was one of those issues that became settled unsettlement. There hadn't been a happy solution. So there was an ambiguity in law that actually began to develop around assisted dying and that became more pronounced after 1993. And that was, first of all, the courts had recognized the difference between passive and active acts of assisting a death. There was also the double effect doctrine that doctors could administer medicine that they knew would cause the death of someone, provided the primary intent was to relieve pain. So a number of people were helped to exit this world in that way. And there was much prosecutorial discretion. There are a number of cases about that. So there was an ambiguity in the law that was very profound, and it left practitioners quite vulnerable, as well as people. So then we moved to 2015 in the Supreme Court of Canada decision in Carter, and they struck down Section 241, but the other parts of the criminal code insofar as they prevented medically assisted dying. And the Supreme Court was very careful in this decision to delineate quite narrow grounds for assisted dying. They and to ensure that it applied to other areas of the criminal code as well, to make the criminal code consistent. So they put fire under the federal government to address this issue, which it did. And in the next chart, you can see there was the federal legislation that has come out, the Supreme Court of Canada decision, the provincial territorial report, and then the Quebec legislative scheme. Quebec is the only government that has enacted legislation to deal with medically assisted dying. So I looked at the different parts and the criteria. If you notice, the criteria is very carefully delineated. It's narrow grounds for medically assisted dying. You have to have a grievous, irremediable, serious, incurable illness, disease or disability. You have to be in an advanced state of irreversible decline, enduring an intolerable suffering, and the forms of pain relief available to you are unacceptable to you. So, and the other schemes embrace similar criteria more or less. So, 5 points of commonality between them. One thing that fascinated me was the naming of. We went from assisted suicide to assisted dying. And part of that is because Canadians were more comfortable with assisted dying than using the term suicide. So it makes what is a contentious act much more palatable. But I have trouble with that, and I still wrestle with this now, because it then makes the person going for a assisted death the subject of a course of events, as opposed to an actor or an agent who is responsible for their own death. And it takes the locus of responsibility away from the individual to broaden it out. And I am uncomfortable with that. However, that's another paper. Other aspects that were similar, very narrow grounds. The medical criteria is very narrow for who can be approved for an assisted, medically assisted death. And there are multiple procedures for approval, and approval being revoked even once you've consented to a medically assisted death. All of them advocated public funding so that we wouldn't get medical tourism in part, but also because we wanted there to be some comparability across the country. And they recognized this was concurrent jurisdiction. The governments had to work together. There had to be public reporting as well. That was considered to be critical. And this made a policy acceptable by establishing comparable standards and limits right across the country. So, the departures then, in terms of public funding, the provinces and territories wanted the issue to go much further to guarantee access to the service in remote areas and across jurisdictions. So if you're leaving one province, you could still get the procedure in another province or territory. They also wanted a federal, provincial, territorial accord to ensure funding, but also to ensure that there was a comprehensive approach to end-of-life care. And the age criteria, there was a difference on that. Also the criteria itself. Age and the criteria for being eligible for an assisted death are very controversial, and they're the place where you're going to get the most action in the courts, especially if Quebec now goes through with its current proposal to consider dementia as one of the bases for an assisted death. But you could get some people saying, well, if it's tolerated in one area of the country, then it should be tolerated in another. Or if I have access in one place, I should have access in other communities. So this means that you could open it up to legal challenges. The other major problem with the legislation is dealing with medical practitioners. The criminal code liability has been removed. But if medical practitioners are in violation of the standards of their profession, or the regulatory standards, they might now, because of the way the legislation is written, be criminally liable in a way that doctors never have or other professions for not abiding by their fresh professional responsibilities. So that's a problem, and they also are not indemnified with respect to civil suits. So there's a problem here. And Quebec, we've seen even the doctors are arguing that it's very contentious. So, when I turn to the evaluation then, I think we have to say some progress has clearly been made. We do have a national framework under the legislation. We have federal websites that acknowledge the provincial roles. Thank you. 2 minutes, perfect. And the provinces and territories have their own websites. They all refer to palliative care, but in different ways. And all jurisdictions now have coordinated care services, which was one of the objectives of all of the governments in getting together. But there are clear differences. There's no consistent approach to palliative and end-of-life care. Quebec has a full-spectrum approach, and if the virtues of federalism play out, then perhaps that will become a model for the other communities. Quebec has also documented its instances very well, and they estimate about 2% of people dying are approved for an assisted death. Nunavut emphasizes palliative care rather than assisted dying. You have to look more for the provisions on assisted dying, and the smaller provinces are struggling. They're very much struggling with how to provide this service, how to get their doctors the training, and how to fund it. We don't have answers on that. And the national database is not comprehensive because the reporting standards are so different. So I talk about moving from federalism to deep federalism, and I do compare the points in which you see unity and diversity. But then what I was really interested was, where did the citizens fare in all of this, as I mentioned at the outset? The positives and negatives are, so you can read across the chart as I say this, the need is met in a socially responsible way, and governments have definitely responded to public opinion polls in the way they've contoured the exercise of medical assistance in dying. They've very closely followed the tolerance levels of Canadians, which we want the service, but tolerance falls when you remove any of the criteria, then people begin to get more nervous about it. problem is we do have a checkerboarding effect with respect to this policy developing across the country. It's a publicly funded service, but there's no dollar commitment from the federal government, and there's an unevenness that's developing because of that. Commitment to record keeping, but as I said, the monitoring is weaker and some data is not being kept. There's a pledge by all governments, including in the preamble to the federal legislation, for a coordinated service, but no accord has been reached. Quebec models an approach to end-of-life care, but there's no comprehensive approach that's been adopted across the country. National values, with respect to using the word values to Professor Russell, variations and exclusions may prompt legal challenges, and our doctors are vulnerable, and so are the other practitioners involved, including nurses, nursing practitioners, pharmacists, et cetera. We have public administration, but I believe we've compromised a lot of our deals, our ideals, in a publicly administered healthcare system. It's a more compassionate approach for sure, but there are still some serious lacunae in the legislation. And as I said, if Quebec starts to add some of the additional points, then that's going to cause a lot of consternation among the other governments. So how well did our governments do? On the first question, I would give them a clear pass that it does reflect the social balance of forces because they met public opinion, but they also provided a service that is contentious. Have they done it well and in a peaceful means, channeling energies into a positive forum? That's got to be a qualified pass. Have they achieved the balance? There, I think they failed. I'm a prof, so of course, pass, fail. I was going to give A, Bs, and Cs, but then that got really intricate. Until we see an accord, I am very worried on this measure. Are the interests of citizens being served? There, I'm going to give a deferred grade until we see how the courts handle some of the questions that are coming up. Certainly, there are points of vulnerability. And we don't see the fundamental demand of Canadians being met consistently in all polls, and that was, yes, they wanted assisted dying introduced, but they wanted more robust palliative and hospice care, so we truly do have choices at the end of our lives. Overall, we muddled through. Thank you.
Thank you, Katie. So now we go on with our second presenter. Carrie A. Frock is assistant professor in the Faculty of Law at the University of New Brunswick. She's now working on a book entitled The Gendered Constitution. Her research has appeared in publications such as the Canadian Bar Review, the Review of Constitutional Studies, the Canadian Journal of Parliamentary and Political Law, and others. So thank you, Carrie.
Thank you very much. And I'm truly grateful for the organizers for inviting me to speak today. The title of my talk is Federalism a Feminist Issue? The Gender of Division of Powers Jurisprudence. And most of the scholarly analysis of Canada's very first cases challenging legislated sex discrimination is focused on the formalism of the equality analysis under the Canadian Bill of Rights. This is epitomized by the astonishing, but by now apocryphal, finding in Bliss versus Canada that discrimination against pregnant people is not sex discrimination, and any inequality between the sexes is created not by law, but by nature. It was preceded by a case called Lavelle, finding that distinctions that treat all women under it equally badly was not a violation of equality before the law. What has received less attention was the fact that they were lost in part on federalism grounds. The Supreme Court found that the discriminatory eligibility criteria for unemployment insurance in Bliss and Indian Act provisions stripping women of their status for marrying out in Lavelle were integral parts of schemes enacted for a valid federal purpose of discharging the federal government's responsibilities under Section 91 of the Constitution Act 1867. But what interests me about them here is not simply that they're blatantly sexist, but their analyses are gendered in the sense meant by a number of feminist scholars, including Carol Smart. That is, they reinforce and naturalize social ordering according to traditional gender roles, including hegemonic ideals of masculinity and femininity and their respective associations to a number of binary distinctions like public-private, like dependency and independence. Here, the strong implication in these cases is that UI is obviously meant for the male worker and pregnant women in the workplace are unnatural. As far as the Indian Act, it's natural for women's legal status to be subsumed and subordinated to their husbands. And I might add, natural for the federal government to ascertain indigenous belonging. All of the Supreme Court division of powers decisions I've found that are most directly about women or have a particular impact on them have occurred after these cases, Bliss and Lavelle. They range from the constitutionality of provincial regulations to inhibit access to abortion, employment insurance, maternity leave benefits, federal regulation of assisted reproduction, and Quebec's protection from workplace hazards during pregnancy, among others. And what I've found is that the division of powers analysis in these cases are descendants of that in Bliss and Lavelle, though the gendered nature of these cases manifest in a slightly different way. A number of feminist scholars have asserted that the state is male, given who was involved in creating its institutions, given the gender imbalance that continues to exist in its leadership and its central preoccupation. What surprised me was that these federal cases didn't represent a privileging of masculinity and a denigrating of femininity per se, but a clash between competing forms of masculinities performed by the states themselves. Using the theories of U.S. professors Jennifer Carlson and Kristen Goss, I found that the cases represent the court privileging and empowering a neoliberal masculine governance and disempowering a paternal mode of masculine governance. By placing these two modes of masculinity as central to the conflict, the decisions naturalize the masculinity of the state and make the empowerment of a feminist state with gender equality as its core value even more unthinkable. It replicates early equality jurisprudence where, as Mary Eberts has written, women are faced with either paternalism, which at least result in the courts upholding some minimal state protections, or judicial enforcement of an absolutely no sex distinction standard, mainly to the benefit of men. The gendered federalism cases were an ideal platform for clashes and transitions between state masculinities, as most fell within the heyday of neoliberalism in Canada, generally accepted to be sometime in the mid-1970s to the early 2000s. Carlson and Goss describe paternal governance as one in which the state usurps the private prerogatives of men and assume the role of protector. Women are included in civil society mainly as policy beneficiaries, and men continue as political actors. Under neoliberal masculine governance, the state is neutered as protector, and individual men act out masculine prerogative as a form of neoliberal state devolution. Men are envisaged again as household protectors, and women can be actors for the purposes of self-reliance and protection in the absence of a male protector. In neoliberal masculine state governance, gender is viewed notionally as irrelevant, but indeed functionally important. What matters is individual responsibility, ability to exercise free choice, efficiency, independence, and all of these traits are more readily accessible to masculine identities. I would like to discuss one of these gendered federalism cases in detail, given its fascinating place in women's history. And there are other more recent cases, like the employment insurance case, like the assisted reproduction case. But this case is interesting to me because it hasn't undergone a lot of deep analysis by feminist scholars or others. The 1988 Supreme Court decision in Bell versus Canada. And what the court was dealing with there was the constitutionality of pregnancy reassignment provisions in Quebec's occupational health and safety legislation. It permitted pregnant women whose working conditions were physically dangerous to them or their unborn children to obtain a certificate from their doctor and be immediately reassigned or withdraw from the workplace until the birth of the child, and they would be paid replacement income by a fund that the government set up but was paid in by employers. If it sounds a lot like workers' comp, that's kind of the flavor of it. What precipitated the action was Bell's receipt of a certificate from a pregnant telephone operator in Quebec due to her exposure to video display terminals. And at the time, this was 1981, there were grave concerns about the impact of VDTs on fetal health. Bell, a national telecommunications company, challenged the certificate and lost in an application before the provincial adjudicator. It then asked the court to declare that the legislation did not apply to it because it was a federal undertaking. Now, I got into the background of the case, which is really interesting and not at all discussed in the Supreme Court decision. And that background makes clear that Bell's challenge of occupational health and safety legislation that was for the exclusive benefit for women was not coincidental. The history of the Bell Canada workplace was steeped in gender issues. Beginning in the late 1880s, it made a conscious effort to establish a sex-segregated workforce of telephone operators, poorly paid and subject to demeaning work conditions. The operators became unionized within a few decades, but because of interference by Bell, this union presence was destroyed and notionally replaced by what's been called company unions. One after another ineffectual company union remained in place until the summer of 1979, when the Communication Workers of Canada achieved certification. The operators engaged in job action beginning in December 1979, and they walked off the job completely in January 1980 to March 1980, and then they achieved a new contract. The government created the Protective Reassignment Program in 1981, and by July 1981, Bell was disputing a protective reassignment certificate and ultimately the application of provincial protective reassignment legislation. The Canada Labor Code did not include Quebec-style protections for pregnant employees until 1993 and never included compensation for withdrawing from work. The company claimed that the law was inoperative due to the principle that we now know as interjurisdictional immunity. Bell represented what some constitutional scholars have called the high watermark of this doctrine, with the court finding that it is not necessary for a provincial law of general application to go so far as to impair or paralyze a vital part of a federal undertaking to be inoperable, but merely affect it. And the court was, and Justice Betts for the court, was pretty straightforward in saying that the legislation here wouldn't meet an impairment kind of test. Parliament's exclusive legislative jurisdiction over labor relations and working conditions at a federal undertaking were pretty well established by that point. The question was whether these provisions protecting pregnant women and their fetuses from injury due to workforce hazards could be considered a working condition. The employer and the federal government said it was. Quebec said rather it was public health. The application of the most extreme version of this doctrine seems curious. It was hardly a federalism hill to die on, given that the Canada Labor Code to incorporate these kinds of provisions happened in less than a decade. And so to me, this suggested that something else might have been influencing the court's reasons. Gerard Bouchard of Bouchard Taylor Commission fame has said that attempts to promote a neoliberal agenda in Quebec during this golden age of neoliberalism were simply going against the grain. While one might debate this as to whether it's an overgeneralization, Quebec's pregnancy reassignment legislation bore the hallmarks of paternal governance. The focal point of decision-making is the pregnant woman's physician, and his word is binding on the Occupational Health and Safety Commission. From there, the decision is basically taken out of her hands. It's receipt of the certificate that triggers the obligation for the employer to immediately reassign her or remove her from the workforce with compensation. Existing studies have shown that while protective reassignment is at the forefront of this provision, in actual fact, over half of women, 60%, were not reassigned. Seldom did it result in employers adapting the workplace. If pregnant women wanted to stay, they needed to find their own accommodations or simply put up with the risk. If an employer made the decision to send them home, women were seldom able to resist it. So, for better or for worse, the legislation returned women to the private sphere. Quebec's rhetoric in the case also fits this mode of governance. No justification in relation to women's right to equality appears. Rather, it referred to the special protection required for these pregnant women workers that, quote unquote, does not relate to working conditions in the traditional sense. Using Brenda Kossmann's turn of phrase to describe neoliberal ideology, the reason of Justice Betts for the court signaled a priority of work over welfare in characterizing the nature of the occupational health and safety regime, and the pregnancy reassignment provisions in particular. He viewed them as working conditions, as matter of contract, albeit with the addition of minimal statutory conditions. Justice Betts commented that the legislation contained striking similarities with the Canada Labour Code, whose central focus was working conditions. He noted that the Labour Code imposes on a worker a duty to take necessary precautions to ensure his or her safety. However, he said that this duty is owed not to themselves, and by implication, their unborn children, but primarily to their employer, in accordance with the terms of their employment and the main workplace objective of productivity. He sidestepped the lack of protection for pregnant women and their fetuses in the federal code and implied that the right given to gender-neutral workers to refuse work in cases of imminent danger was functionally similar. So the gender-specific protections are superfluous, as is the use of doctors as intermediaries. And to use a Blissian term, pregnant workers are to look after themselves, refuse work where reasonable, and rely on their own resources in the meantime to support themselves while an inspector inspects and potentially makes a remedial order. Betts finds that the provisions concerning preventative reassignment are a working condition in the sense of the right itself to the pregnant worker to a new assignment or reassignment. So the focus here is really on the individual worker asserting her rights in a responsible fashion in accordance with the workplace duties. So feminists have thoughtfully conceptualized the fetus as being in and of the woman. It's connected to her in intimate and intricate ways, socially and physiologically, so it can't be reduced as a body part nor regarded as a separate entity. But consistent with a neoliberal governance mode, a pregnant woman comes across as simply a worker with a temporary extra body part. The court says that the scheme is like regulations requiring safety boots or hard hats. So lastly, the court points to the need for a robust federal immunity to ensure peaceful labor operations in its federal undertakings under the Canada Labor Code. What did the court mean? This was something so obviously not the case here. Rather, the employer was using federalism almost as retaliation against its female workforce, newly unionized by a non-company union and fresh off of a strike. But when you read the court's reasoning, what becomes apparent is this idea of peaceful labor operations is about reducing government and reducing red tape, so that there aren't endless disputes over what regulation applies. So within this frame, protective reassignment surgery is really just another inefficiency caused by paternal governance. So to conclude, the Supreme Court has been quite solicitous of federalism when determining rights claims. The judgment in Quebec versus A concerning spousal support and property rights of women in common law relationships is only the most recent example. So why can't the court be equally solicitous of rights when determining federalism cases? In the course of patriation, Canada recognized gender equality as one of its preeminent values. Women fought for changes in the Constitution, specifically to avoid future Blisses and Lavelles. If that is the case, then the days in which the masculine states are allowed to defend their exclusive jurisdictions under division of power arguments, where women are simply unfortunate collateral damage, should be consigned to the past.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Kerry. Now, our last presenter, Mary Eberts. So Mary's legal practice concentrates on equality and human rights. She's a co-founder of the Women's League's Education and Action Fund and was legal counsel to the Native Women's Association of Canada for 25 years. So her involvement in many issues regarding women's rights, natives, right, and she was also associated with cases on the Meech Lake and Charlottetown Accords. So she has a good knowledge of our constitution. Thank you, Mary.
I'm going to sit here because experience has taught me that if I get up at a lectern, I won't follow my notes. I'll just orate. So I'm giving my notes a chance. Thank you very much for inviting me here. The topic that I have chosen to speak about is, can Indigenous self-government or Indigenous sovereignty fit within the Canadian federal system? My starting point is a set of observations by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada. They say, and I'll start with this, that reconciliation not only requires apologies, reparations, the relearning of Canada's national history, and public commemoration, but also needs real social, political, and economic change. And it's the political change part of that that I'm interested in. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission goes back and recaptures observations and conclusions of the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples, pointing out that RCAP emphasized that Aboriginal people's right to self-determination is essential to a robust upholding of Canada's constitutional obligations. And it too said that a change to conduct is necessary. And this observation of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission reminds me somewhat of another observation made by Justice Binney in the Supreme Court of Canada in discussing reconciliation. The Truth and Reconciliation points out that to the Government of Canada, reconciliation entails Aboriginal people's acceptance of the reality of Crown sovereignty and parliamentary supremacy in order to allow government to get on with business. Aboriginal people, on the other hand, see reconciliation as an opportunity to affirm their own sovereignty and return to the partnership ambitions they had after Confederation. And I would just vary that quote a bit by saying that the partnership ambitions were held not just after Confederation, but before Confederation, during a period when there was a very fruitful military and also social partnership between the colonial governments of the day and Indigenous peoples, which many scholars place at an end, or they say that the start of the deterioration of that relationship was the winning by Canadian and British forces of the War of 1812. So, with this background and the proposition that reconciliation needs and must be accompanied by political change and the observation that Indigenous sovereignty and self-government is a necessary piece of reconciliation, I consider the question of whether Indigenous governing, Indigenous sovereignty or self-determination can be accommodated within the federal system as it now exists. And I begin my observations by pointing out that the Indigenous peoples of Canada now do not have a European power sitting at a treaty-making table on their behalf, as was the case when some of Quebec's lawmaking power was recognized by the British conquerors. In that deal made between France and England, the party on the soil of Canada was benefited. There is no European power sitting at the table when the Indigenous peoples talk to the government of Canada or any other government in Canada. And so we wonder, I wonder, if it takes a European sponsor to get a good deal from Canada and the other governments. And if so, then I think Aboriginal people had better resume those trips over to the Queen and the Pope that were so much a part of diplomacy in the early 19th century. The starting point of my analysis of Indigenous sovereignty starts with the very problematic relationship that now exists between the Canadian state and Indigenous law. Indigenous lawmaking being an essential element of sovereignty and self-government. When the Europeans came to Canada, they found societies which had intact legal systems and that were governing matters of relations between individuals, keeping the peace, land use, and a host of other subjects. And there was no official banning of Indigenous law, per se, although some would say that the banning of certain ceremonies was in part an attack on Indigenous law. Nor was there a total capture of Indigenous law and its restyling, as happened with some customary law of African peoples. It was sucked up into the legal system and was adapted to suit the courts of the colonizer, but it was still called customary law. So what happened is a sort of a checkerboard. The criminal law of a number of the First Nations was superseded by Canadian criminal law, which was imposed on First Peoples through the use of police and even, in some cases, armed force. Scholar Hadley Friedland has pointed out that there were trials and convictions under Canadian law of people who had, pursuant to their own law, taken necessary steps to deal with the negative effects of Wendigos in their society. However, there was recognition by some courts of marriage under Indigenous law and also of adoption under Indigenous law, and there has been quite a lot of work done on both of those subjects. However, the Canadian state never recognized Indigenous divorce and remarriage permissions. It didn't suit them to do that. And there was never a case that came up into a Canadian common law court or civil law court where that became an issue. We see as well that there are a number of aspects of Indigenous land law or land use law that have been recognized in tribunal hearings or in case law. We also see that there were great gaps in the willingness of the Canadian state to extend its rule of law to Indigenous peoples, and that went right up on through to 2008 easily with the final repeal of Section 67 of the Canadian Human Rights Act, which held that the act did not apply to the Indian Act. And so we have a very compromised situation in an exceptionally important part of sovereignty. And this is where I turn to another element of federalism that does actually bode somewhat well for this enterprise. And that is to the fact that federalism in Canada has evolved and grown incrementally through the practical steps that both governments and those affected by them have taken over the years. When it finally surfaces above a certain level, it may be characterized or recognized by the court or by scholars as involving a certain element. But before that happens, there is a fairly thick root system put together through practical applications. There are many situations in Canada now where Indigenous peoples are exercising lawmaking power. There are situations where Indigenous peoples continue to exercise Indigenous-rooted lawmaking power. There are some unfortunate situations where the government of Canada sees fit to style Aboriginal lawmaking power, or Indigenous lawmaking power, as something that they got from the Indian Act. It's delegated power from Canada. And matrimonial law is one of them, where in Indigenous societies, there were all kinds of laws governing what happens on a separation. But Canada, in its wisdom, has said that Indian bands can make those laws under the Indian Act. Canada is happier with delegated power than with the idea of original lawmaking power. There are also land claims agreements, and there are self-government agreements which describe lawmaking power of First Nations. And it is an interesting observation the extent to which these nations are inspecting their own lawmaking pasts as guideposts to how they should exercise the power that is recognized in the agreement. The Supreme Court of Canada has not gone all the way to recognizing Indigenous lawmaking power as an element of sovereignty which should be respected, an element which legitimizes Indigenous claims to sovereignty. Rather, it has said, and I'm looking at Dalgamuch now and a couple of other cases, in a somewhat confusing language, that the fact that First Peoples were here and had legal systems of their own when the Europeans arrived is one of the roots of the rights that they now have in Canadian law. And so the edifice of Canadian law under Section 35 of the Charter and of the Constitution Act, and before that, ordinary Canadian law with respect to land claims, is found in Indigenous law. But the Indigenous law is not elevated to the level of the act, an act of a sovereign state. And the cases mention frequently that this approach is one way of helping Indigenous people, or seeing that Indigenous people will reconcile themselves to the sovereignty of the Canadian state. So if we take Professor Russell's definition of federalism as shared sovereignty, we have to see that Canada so far is, at the very best, we can say, confused on the subject. It goes all the way to the edge, and yet it refuses to jump over the cliff. It will recognize in certain instances of the lawmaking power of Indigenous peoples, but then it sort of sucks it up and incorporates it into its own law. For example, it recognizes Haudenosaunee jurisdiction over marriage, and yet the elders at Six Nations who perform marriages go and get a license from the Ontario government in order to do so. just because that means there are fewer problems for people down the road. And so I think that part of the installation of Indigenous sovereignty and self-government in Canadian federalism, before we get to the large edifice that was contemplated in the Charlottetown Accord, the architecture, if you will, of, you know, this house and the other house and this and that and at the federal government level, at the Canadian level, we need to create that thick web of root hairs in which we see the Canadian government and all official governments of Canada, provincial, territorial, actually recognizing on a day-to-day basis in many practical contexts the sovereign lawmaking power of Indigenous nations. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for three very interesting and presentations. So we still have time for questions. Alors, je vous inviterai à poser des questions à nos panélistes. Pas beaucoup.
One person is getting up.
Wait. Yep.
Oh, he's just going outside.
For the translators.
Oh.
Thank you. Okay, I was very interested in the first speaker's analysis of assisted dying in relation to federalism, and I was wondering if she could apply that framework to the legalization of marijuana.
It's funny you mention that, because that is going to be my next paper, comparing the two and how they're handled. because there are so many striking parallels, and the biggest one, of course, is when you have a decision like this that is made, and then the governments have to react, and the federal government changes criminal code, it creates a whole host of changes at the provincial level, and some governments have more capacity to deal with that as quickly than others, and that's why we're seeing the delays and the protests by the provinces on the issue now. So once I've studied it, I'll be able to answer in more depth.
I had actually a very similar question, but in the sense that we were there's, I think, two instances of talking about checkerboarding. So one of the benefits, I'm not very well-versed in how governance actually works, very shallow detail, but it seems like one of the benefits of checkerboarding is that there is a certain amount of trial and error that can involve empirical trial and error, both specifically with regards to the suicide, but also a little bit on the Indigenous aspects as well. So it seems like one of the benefits of having a broad federal policy that allows for trial and error is that they can then compare. But obviously one of the issues is that there's then no obligation to actually settle. And so it was very interesting how you were discussing the balance between unity and diversity. Do you think that it is about striking a balance, or do you think that it has to be a little more fluid than that, where they need to be allowed a period of trial and error, especially on the topic of medical marijuana as well, and then have almost, I don't know how it would work, but like a second review of the law where there would be a more convergence towards unity? Might be a little too complicated.
That's a really great question. And in the case of MAID, and notice that they called it MAID, not medically assisted dying as they did at first, mm-hmm. because they went from MAD to MAID, very deliberately, to try to help legitimize it. On that one, the legislation in Quebec is really interesting, and it's providing a good example of the experimentation that can go on in federalism, and then the other jurisdictions can learn from that. So this is one of the reasons why I want to see a national accord, and I want to see more national reporting in a coordinated way, because I think those practices should be transferred between jurisdictions as they continue to learn. Perhaps at the 5-year review period of the legislation, there will be more transference of practices. So when I see balance, I think that it's allowing the diversity and then having the jurisdictions learn from each other, but also having an overarching framework so that you do have some common standards for citizens. And although I wouldn't want to see all practices identical, I think you do need that back and forth. One other example would be Nunavut that I mentioned quickly. The issue of suicide is so serious there, as in the Northwest Territories, that yes, you want to have palliative care and other options promoted first as part of their dealing with the issue of suicide. So that checkerboarding is necessary, but I like to see the exchange of practices to a greater extent too.
I think the checkerboarding that I referred to is just a fact of life. It's not happening by design, but I think that it is an important way for different situations to adjust themselves to explore what they can do. And there is a lot of information sharing between Indigenous governments about how to do this. And eventually it will, I think, inform developments at the higher level of statecraft.
Last one?
Last question.
Okay.
Sorry.
My question is mainly directed to Professor Eberts. So last year around this time, Osgoode had its annual Anishinaabe Law Camp, led by Professor John Burroughs, a great Indigenous scholar from UVictoria. And so we had the chance to visit a reserve territory guided by Professor Burroughs. And the sort of main theme of the camp was, you know, what are Indigenous legal orders and what is Indigenous law? And we learned so much throughout the weekend about this. And one very striking methodology that Professor Burroughs was teaching us about is that a lot of Indigenous legal principles come from the oral tradition and from Indigenous stories. And so he and his daughter are working on a project to do case briefs, you know, traditional legal case briefs of Indigenous stories to kind of pull legal principles from the stories. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that methodology as a means of helping to guide this process of reconciliation of different Indigenous orders and acknowledging of Indigenous sovereignty.
Well, I'm glad you got to go to Anishinaabe camp. I went 1 year. It's wonderful. And the methodology of Professor Burroughs and his daughter is the methodology that is developed actually at the Indigenous Law Research Unit at the University of Victoria Law School. I went to a workshop in that methodology up in Fort St. John a number of years ago. They've been at it for a long while, and they actually go, teams of people from the Indigenous Law Research Unit will actually go and work with communities who are interested in recapturing their law, and they will spend time with them listening to the stories and workshopping the stories in that exact way. What wisdom do we get from this? What principles do we get from this story? And that informs the development of, in a couple of communities, it has informed the development of child welfare codes. In another one, it has developed their approach to water law. So this is actually happening now, and it is a very, very productive way of dealing with things.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. So please join me to thank our presenters, our speakers.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Francis, and the rest of the panel. We'll have the final panel of the conference on elections, and we'll give them a minute to get here. Right?